Okay, thank you. Okay, so this will be the last talk, last lecture of the week, and also of this year's CIDR. So in a way, I would say people probably would expect me to provide a little like a synthesis talk, but that might be, I feel that's pretty hard. I mean, it's my first time to CIDR. I will see how it goes. So overall, this is like a still the last geodynamic talk. I will mostly talking about the modeling techniques, forward in time, backward in time, exactly. I will focus on the I will focus on the different approaches. There are several commonly used approaches, and I will try to give some examples. So I actually have a lot of slides, 80, 90, but they are like transitional slides. So let's see how it goes. And so let's start with the motivation, right? So why do we do modeling, and what is data-oriented modeling? That's like the purpose of this talk. I mean, why do we even bother in the first place? You know, we start with this. This is like, that's my only synthesized slide. Okay, so I mean, Bruce used this slide. I checked the video from last week. I was not here. It's a very famous cartoon, right? I mean, blind, and different people will see different parts of the F, and they would tell different stories. And, well, there's different ways to interpret this meaning of this, right? In a way, it fits CIDR very well because, I would say all people in the room, including the experimentalists, like seismologists and mineral physicists, geochemists, and modelers, of course, we're all actually some way doing models, right? Because ultimately, for your data, for your interpretation, you'll come up with a story that's, you know, telling a story about certain aspect of the Earth. It's a model, right? So, but we also all know about this famous quote, "All models are wrong, and although some are useful," right? So when I first heard this, I kind of feel little, not disturbing, but like depressing. You know? So how many of you have a similar feeling, right? I mean, honestly, can you raise your hand if you totally think this is fine, if it's entirely okay? I see one. Okay, thank you. Thank you. So I mean, the reason we are here, we're all doing kind of like, to some extent, modeling. I kind of think this is a little bit pessimistic. So if we can, you know, I want to change this quote a little bit, you know. I would say like all models are useful. It's just a matter of more or less, right? So now it's semantic. It's semantic. It may make you feel a little better. So and also to make you feel better again, I would say I would use a quote. This is actually a very recent National Academy of Science, a National Academy's report. So they this cartoon I drew this, but basically they're talking about different disciplines in the scientific discovery or earth science, or even science in general. There are different four pillars of scientific discovery, right? This is like the whole science, and we have different pillars, like different approaches to approach this problem. And the traditional, you know, pillars, do you know about that? What are the traditional way of doing science? You know, it's theory, right? Oops, theory and experimentation. So this is, you know, well known, centuries of work. And there are two new pillars, or relatively new pillars, and they call computation and data-driven science, right? These are kind of like listed in the kind of report. I found it somewhere from NSF website. So then that makes us, you know, happy, right? So we are doing something meaningful, and that's probably needed, especially for this time when things are going multidisciplinary. We are talking about complex systems instead of, you know, disciplinary, idealized systems. So then the question is, what is really data-driven Earth model? Let's focus on, you know, several, you know, words that we are restricting to a relatively specific area. So Earth model. What is the Earth model? I mean, this is the model, right? Actually, any model, broadly speaking, all the models, they use certain kind of data. Like this is famous cartoon at the time of plate tectonics. And there's data, like, you know, the paleomagnetic data, right? Marine magnetics. It's just that this interpretation is a little too romantic, I would say. But still, it's a model, right? So, question? No. Well, scientifically, when we talk about data-driven Earth model, we specifically say, at least my own definition, I would prefer this is, we are looking at models that are assimilating or taking into as model parameters, geologically and geophysically observed data constraint, right? So, and there are a lot of like earlier works, like one of the pioneer work by Brad Hager. You know, you may not realize this is like a data summation model, but it is, right? It's an instantaneous model. It basically try to, excuse me, calculate the geoid associated with subduction or slabs. And there are basically he used, I think, the deep seismicity or the Benioff zone to prescribe the distribution of the slabs, and that provides a density, and then he calculates the geoid response, which also introduced the concept of dynamic topography. It's a very classic paper, and I will not talk about the details. And then also there is pioneering evolutionary models, which is a forward model, and this is by Carolina, which I in the audience. It's a very influential paper. So this is looking at the distribution of slabs in a pretty much similar way to the previous paper, but at different times. You know, at that time, we already had enough information about the plate reconstruction. We know the Earth's surface plates are moving around, and the trench location is different. And then, you know, you can parameterize the density structure this way by assuming a certain, you know, deep angle, whatever, of the slab. Then you get information out. And then this is, you know, the earlier work, and the reason I will use one of our work, also evolutionary models, but exactly a backward model. So this is our most recent work. So we are looking at the evolution of the one-focus subduction as well as the evolution of the hot mantle that's widespread below Western US. So we're talking about making a story about Yellowstone. So we'll talk about that a little more later. So these are different types of data, a data-driven model or data simulation model that you can refer to. So the kind of data we have, as you can see, oh, what happened to my slide? Okay. So this, I mean, seismology arguably provides the most powerful constraint. And we talk a lot about seismology in this session, and I will not go into details. But the end product of that, one very important is the seismic tomography, right? This is one of the earlier models by Vanderhoust, and you see the very well imaged Farallon slab, the Tessin slab, these two major subduction zones are well imaged. And these structures are quite robust, because we still see the same feature more or less today. And of course, seismic anisotropy, this is another very unique type, like Maureen talked about this, is actually very useful because this tells us, potentially tells us, the past accumulation of deformation in the mantle, especially in the upper mantle, right? So these are, I would say, complementary data constraints that we can use for understanding the Earth's evolution. And then, over time, we also have the surface motion of the Earth, the so-called plate tectonics, in the general term. Actually, this is particularly called plate reconstruction. So this model is pretty well widely used. I'm not saying this is the model. You know, I mean, there's a lot of information going into this model. I mean, we have to respect the effort. Of course, there are uncertainties, especially going backward in time. We'll talk about that. But, and arguably, this provides a very important constraint on the surface motion of the Earth as a function of time. So putting everything together, you know, we think about the evolution of the Earth, I would use a mathematical view on this, like I call the equation. So with depths, you know, that's going to the interior of the Earth. Over time, we are going from the past to the present. So I list the knowns of the equations as blue colors, like plate motion on the surface and the present-day mantle state. You know, there are all kinds of data. Besides as much, there's MT, there's other data, right? A lot of the constraints. But the unknown is mostly in the past, and especially in the interior of the Earth. So that's how the Earth system now is, you know, set up as an equation. Then, so moving to the second part I want to talk about, there are different approaches people try to approximate the evolution of the Earth, right? Here we focus again on the data simulation. So roughly speaking, you can think about this. When you think about the model, right, you can think about either a forward in time integration of the governing equations, and Bruce gave an excellent lecture. I did watch that movie you made from last week. And so the governing equations are very well known. We know that the Earth, the mantle convection, for example, the governing equations are pretty well known, not very well, pretty well known. The uncertainty is in the parameters, right? We really don't know. The viscosity, density, these are the main uncertainties. And also, you remember the governing equations of the Earth in a well-posed sense is going forward in time. So this is a natural way of thinking about Earth's evolution and building models, or sometimes we also call the sequential approach. So you assimilate data, and basically you train the model. You run the model forward and while you assimilate data. So in a way, it's kind of like a Kármán filter. You probably know that, right? So so this approach is actually pretty good. It takes advantage of the plate reconstruction, every detail information from reconstruction. If you Well, there's uncertainty, of course, but still to the first order is a very important constraint. But a known problem is the initial condition is not known, right? It's exactly a very common problem. And then you can think about backward in time integration. This is actually a little bit counterintuitive because we usually think about things moving forward. But mathematically, you do have ways of approximating this backward integration. And the reason is because we really have the most information about the Earth at the present day, right? So if you can theoretically do that going backward in time, then you really take advantage of the present day constraint, right? But this one, there's actually problems with this as well. For example, one of this is the resolution, right? The tomography has a limited resolution, even though after decades of development, but still there's a limit. We can easily reach that limit from a modeling point of view. So now I want to talk a little bit about the forward simulation. So the as I said, the idea here is actually, okay, so I'll show that. I have this moment. So here, we start with an unknown, say entirely known or poorly known initial condition. People have different ways of approximating the initial condition as well. Let's just say it's poorly known. And then you, then you use the plane motion history as a boundary condition, right? I will not talk about the technical details, but you can do that. It's a way of simulating the kinematics on surface, and that will actually create mental structures over time. So by the present day, you get a structure. Okay, it depends on your model parameters. You get different structures. But actually, people have shown this from a theoretical point of view. If you have a perfectly known plane motion history, the structure at the present day is not too off. It's pretty good. Okay, if your mental viscosity is not too off, you know, that's important a principle to remember. And then over this course, you can get increasingly clearer knowledge about the geology, the surface response of the deeper mental processes. It's really a straightforward idea. So I want to talk spend a few words on the progress of this forward modeling approach, because this is really the majority of the geodynamic model by now. So this actually includes both instantaneous models, like all the geoid models, like geoid, we'll talk about gravity invariant, these are all instantaneous models. And people also use that to predict the plane motion. You know, the current day, present day plane motion is also a, several groups are doing that. Of course, the result of that is not necessarily all consistent. We have evolutionary model, time-dependent models as well. So this is used to study subduction, mental structure, plane motion, dynamic topography. Oh, well, I have to add, this also involves dynamic topography because gravity itself is has a contribution from dynamic topography. So if we look at the instantaneous models here, again, one of the earlier examples is Hager's work. Again, it's 85. So basically, they convert the first generation, like Dzhonsky type of tomography, to a buoyancy structure, and then they calculate the surface response and they calculate geoid, right? I mean, Max talked about this in a lot more detail, so I will not go into the details here. So this is the predicted geoid, and that's observed geoid. And I believe at that time, these two RSVPs are assumed to be purely thermal. So now we change our view to be like thermochemical, something to keep in mind. This is like a more recent paper talking about geoid again. This based on S40 RTS, or S20 RTS, I believe. So they are looking at the geoid more like at the finer scale. Say they are particularly focusing on the low geoid lows surrounding the Pacific, and their conclusion is that the slab piles you can see in this blue contour are underlain by slow anomalies. It looks like a mirror image, one pairs of hot anomaly, not hot anomaly. Slow anomaly on top, fast anomaly underneath. And they found that to best match these geoid lows, this slow anomaly has to be something buoyant. And because of spatial correlation, they suggest or speculate these are water coming out from flat pile, which is quite creative. So that goes to the deep water circulation, okay? So I'm going to give you, so I try to tie it to this heterogeneity, deep Earth. I'm not really a deep Earth person, but this is one example. So instantaneous model, looking at the plane motion again, Klein's and Carolina's work, and so they actually match the predicted plane motion. Which one is that? Sorry, I didn't look carefully. This is the their observation. They can match that pretty well, and their conclusion is that the driving force of plate motion is kind of half-half between slab pull and then mantle suction, like convection pattern overall. And then like several years later, this is like one of the earlier papers using the very fancy technique called adaptive mesh refinement. It's not aspect, it's real, right? So it's similar instantaneous model, and they also match the plate motion. Of course, their conclusion is slightly different, except they don't need traction force, just the slab itself is fine. You know, you see the debates, right? So it's not entirely solved, I would say. And then time-dependent subduction models, this is really because we have the kind of data we talked about, plate reconstruction in particular inside and the seismology and geophysical imaging techniques. So to show some of the earlier work, and you see that again, Carolina, you pop out so many times, Carolina. So this is the reviews of geophysics paper. So because I always remember this paper, you know, that you can actually predict the plane motion, you know, to some extent backward in time, you know, sometime in the past. It's still a forward model, right? But so in a way, it's one of the pioneering work. You can think about this time evolutionary model that can also look at plane motion prediction as well as dynamic topography. This is my former supervisor's work. So they look at the Phanerozoic inundation history of the entire of the global continent. So you can see that. I will not go to the details, but dynamic topography plate motion are two of the most important implications. Okay, so going to very recent work by, say, Bauer, still the Caltech or the Sydney group. This is also data simulation, and this is actually is requiring a lot of effort because this is looking at much finer scale structure like slabs. Like previous models, the slabs are really, I mean, roughly parameterized. But in this case, you can see the slab really is following the half space cooling model, anyway, the thermal boundary layer theory. So it's pretty much refined. But the problem is that for this kind of model, it's really demanding. I mean, we saw a lot of talks from the past when we got to subduction can behave very nicely, the slab looks very natural looking, but it's not the case here. And data simulation model, we cannot do that. We are still technically beyond that capability because the plane motion, you know, velocity, you know, direction change over time, the geometry of the plate changes. It's really hard to generate a self-consistent model while matching the surface observation as well as the internal structure. So anyways, this is one way to approach that problem. So they basically prescribe the slabs in the upper mantle. So all slabs are dipping at 45 degree angle to the base of the upper mantle, right? So this kind of model you can imagine, to the first order is still good. I mean, it can match topography to some extent, and especially it's good for understanding the dynamics and evolution of the lower mantle in particular, right? But talking about surface or close to surface processes like the upper mantle, so especially we talk about seismic anisotropy, and this model would not be very good because the slab is rigid, right? It's not evolutionary. I mean, it's not dynamically evolving, therefore the mantle flow is not accurate. And also another thing is, say, intraplate deformation, like upper plate deformation, right? GRD tectonics. This also has limitations. So that's why recently we published a paper and we run a global model as well. It's super expensive, I have to be honest. So in this case, our slab subduction is more natural. In a way, we do not impose the slab, we just impose the surface plate motion. But instead, we use like tracers, you know, whatever way to decouple the slab. And this is actually a common way people are doing that in, you know, in other talks you see, like Magli showed a very nice subduction geometry using tracer. I assume the tracer, right? So we use similar techniques so the slabs can evolve by itself. That's pretty much today. So, and I will talk about some examples of this particular forward approach. So one example is a recent model we ran, and this is a prediction of the slab structure underneath South America. As you see, this is the Nazca plate, and that's the continent on top, so to orient yourself. And in particular, this model, when we run it, you can imagine, so we start from 100 million years mid-Cretaceous, so this is a westward view, and there's like a ridge subduction at that time. So this is the northern part of the west coast of South America, so you roughly see the slabs coming downward here. And so forward in time, you see the slab really has a lot of variability along the trench, right? It's not, because we're not imposing the geometry. And eventually we have a lot of these, you know, discontinuity. This is like the natural ridge right now, you know, the very, very complex dynamics. We haven't, we should look at this, but so a lot of interesting features. And in particular, we were, for the published paper, we were focusing on the shallow, on the flat slabs, you know, South America. Oh, go ahead.
In the dynamic simulation, what do the holes represent?
Sorry,
what
the hole?
Do the holes in the slab represent?
Where there's a hole, right? Yeah, so these are the holes. I mean, actually, I'm zooming into these holes. So actually, what we found interesting enough is what we found is like all these flat slabs, so the northern Peru, southern Peru, and central Chile, these flat slabs are all internally broken. So so why is that? You know, I mean, to verify that, I mean, from seismicity, you do see that these holes are correlated with like a sparsity of seismicity. There's almost like no earthquake. So what we found caused the hole is like, first of all, is the buoyancy feature subduction, like the aseismic ridges. When they subduct, they try to create a flat slab from initially, you know, steep slab. And that actually create an internal extension, you know, and that will quickly localize the strain and eventually the thins. I'm not, yeah, to say this is like a hole is not entirely true because it's just like a warm area. So it's like necking within a uniform slab. So, but anyway, now it actually matches the geometry of the Benioff zone. So these white lines are Benioff zones. It matches that quite well, and that's the only way we can match it. So we run a lot of models. And for all models, especially for data simulation models, there are too many knobs. We run hundreds of models. You know, this is like the best. Another good thing about this data simulation model is that it's flexible, right? It's expandable. So I mean, the next step when we have this model, it actually matches tomography pretty well as well. And you can use the manual flow, because if you have the right structure, you should have more or less the right manual flow. And then you can really talk to the other seismic constraint like anisotropy, right? So we use the manual flow history, and we forward chain the Dirac code, basically. And you know, Torsten here did a lot of work on that, and we actually use his package, like PSTrack. So we FSTrack, sorry. So we actually predict the the anisotropy. This is like a distribution of anisotropy over depths, pretty much within the thinosphere. And you see that. Don't worry, which is observation, which is data. So they match pretty well in the ocean. I think black is data from the UCRA group. And the normal mode anisotropy. But within the continent, it's not very well. But overall, you see a large scale pattern. It's pretty simple, right? It's like a radiating pattern or converging pattern that's mimicking the overall subduction geometry, because there's a kink in the slab. So it's a subduction driven or slab controlled environment, flow environment. And within the continent, the fit is actually generally worse, and that's not surprising because we know continent is not necessarily deforming with the mantle. But if you look at the depth integrated as KS, color here is the angular misfit, we actually get a very good fit within one of the cratons, the San Francisco craton. And the Amazonian is generally poor, and there's very little splitting. That's consistent with the old craton being stable, being not deformed. But this is an exception. It's a very large splitting, and it's parallel to the thinospheric flow underneath. And this is actually interesting. Then we look at this a little more, and we look at different depths from 50 all the way to the thinosphere, and we found that within the lithosphere itself, especially the lower lithosphere, so 100 kilometers and below, the alignment is very good. Same thing for Africa. We actually found something similar to in Africa. So this pink color here represents actually high topography, and that's actually the next slide. So the interesting observation here is that the high topography craton actually has is lower lithosphere realigned with recent mantle flow. This is actually, everything here is bizarre. I mean, cratons, if they are stable, they should be low elevation because the weather will easily remove topography over billions of years. But they are not. They are high, right? And they are anisotropically realigned underneath the root. And then if you look at the geology, right? So the hotspots are, we use the hotspot reconstruction. You can see that for this region, look at the color here. Roughly in the Cretaceous time, this region where you have the high topography or where hotspots intersect with the continent. And if you look at the other geology, like the Arctic history, the roofing history, both South America and Africa, they have two phases of rapid extinction, up to 5-7 kilometers, according to the some of the thermal chronology studies. So it's a huge amount. And then if you've got sedimentation history, this is sedimentation around surrounding Africa. They have similar peaks. Right? Synodontia is not much. This is, of course, integral. And then if you look at the volcanic eruption, here I'm looking at the kimberlite. They have, you know, it's all correlated, right? So Cretaceous, this looks like a special time. And if you look at seismic tomography, so the high craton here and here, and they are underlain by a very thick lithosphere today.
Sorry. Can we go back?
Sure.
You lost me.
Okay.
Okay, what's red, what's green, where is it measured? And on the bottom one.
Oh, here.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Kimberlite eruption frequency is the red. That's like a histogram.
In South Africa?
Oh, that's right. This is all in South Africa. There's not much here, but yeah. This particular study is from a review paper that they don't consider here. But if from the literature, you can see they are similar here. And this is a sediment flux.
Sediment flux where?
Surrounding Africa, again. These are all from Africa.
Okay, so that's a proxy for elevation.
For erosion, directly.
Yeah.
Right, erosion, then you can see it's uplift. And that's consistent with the unroofing or exhumation. So it seems all correlated.
Okay.
And then we look at the mantle tomography. It's interesting. I mean, the lithosphere all kind of seem to be intact. They're pretty cold. The heat flow is actually low on top. But if you look below that, you see these patches of fast anomalies. And that's why I want to go introduce this one, because this is potentially heterogeneity, right? So they are all above 660. You know, huge patches. I mean, Scott King, you before previously interpreted this as edge-driven convection, right? Like a thermal convection. But, you know, but they are actually not necessarily slabs, because the slab is here. And these are before below the passive margin. So for at least 200 million years, there's no subduction. Why they are so prominent and they are shallow, right? And then what we look later on, we actually look at anisotropy again. You know, besides this model is our slab model, you know, it matches the anisotropy well. But then if you use the tomography instead, you convert those fast anomalies to be high density anomalies, then you don't generate local convection. And that destroyed the entire anisotropy pattern. So our argument here is these are neutrally born stuff that probably represent the laminar lithosphere. So I will not go into detail here, but you can check the paper. So another example, you know, this will be a basis for the universe model. This is the Western US, the wonderful subduction, or the late Farallon. So the way we do here is, this is the temperature field at 20 kilometers, you see the Farallon plate, Pacific, so that's North America. And then the slab, again, is not imposed, but it's pushed to, initially at least, to emerge. And so this is a cross-section, the same cross-section, 41 North, you know. It's a favorite latitude for all the tomographers, because they show this, eventually they show this double slab, whatever. So we model this, and one thing I want to point out is that the triangle here represents the trench. So we talked about trench retreat in Cascadia, and this is an example. So before 20, the retreat is actually pretty normal. So the yellow lines here is a craton location. So basically there's no extension. Okay, so the triangle and the craton move at the same rate. And you have regular subduction. But starting mid-Miocene, things start to get crazier because the triangle moves a lot faster than the craton. So you have basin rent extension at that particular latitude, and you got the slab teared from the hinge. And you compare this particular geometry with the tomography, there are different tomographies, and they look kind of similar, like two or three segments. And of course, the good thing about this model is the change, you know, the slab hinge looks more natural than all the tomography, which is vertically smeared, we know that, right? So that's actually important for modeling the universe model I will talk about to consider this kind of artifact. We know that's an artifact.
Any questions?
Sure.
So what causes the slab to break in this model?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, I will try. I know. That's a very good question. For this data simulation model, so many parameters are going to the same model. It's actually, it takes time to understand what's going on. Same here. So if we look at the comparison first, I mean, I would just want to say this is the model that fits tomography fairly well. So this is Karen's tomography at different depths, that's the model prediction. You have a continuous slab at shallow depths, and it kind of breaks. You see the hole in the slab. And more interesting is in the transition zone. So if you look at the transition zone, There's a semicircular pattern, or some people call it the horseshoe geometry. It actually matches the model as well. So it's very 3D. You know, you have a 2D subduction, but it's got a very 3D structure. And the reason, back to Lawrence's question, the reason why it caused the particular region to tear or to break or to neck, we think the reason is if you look at this particular, this is the, how say this? This is a pseudo 3D view of the subduction system. I'm trying to show the depths of the slab edge at, you know, with different colors. So you see a pseudo 3D. At 20 million years, you know, everything's still normal. You have a pretty much 2D geometry. But the slab is not very wide. And we actually saw, it's Max who talked about this, the width of the slab is actually very important. When it's narrower to a critical value, the edge-driven flow becomes very important. And the current of the so-called toroidal flow, when this becomes important, it affects the dynamics of the interior, right? So the one important end result of the toroidal flow is it releases the pressure underneath the slab, because that's what drives the flow. You know, kind of like a circular argument. But overall, when you have close to the edge, the slab, the thinness there underneath the slab is not being very much pressed, because it's like a channel. But close to the center, the material doesn't know where to go, right? So there's actually relatively high dynamic pressure underneath the center. And given the fact also that the one Foucault plate is very young, at this particular time, like 15 million years. So it's very young, very weak, and that helps. I think that's one of the most critical reasons that actually pumps open the center of the slab and form a hole. So when that happens, you know, the slab, the already narrow slab becomes even narrower. You have several segments. And then the toroidal flow becomes very, very important, right? So then you start to see this rolling effect. All these small segments tend to roll into like rows, and that's what you see today. So it's a very complex structure. And this actually matches the tomography I just showed. And did that answer your question? We try to change the other parameters, like the plane motion a little bit. It doesn't really create the right geometry. So this is the key parameter we found. So yeah, and one of the implications of this is if this did happen in the mid-Miocene, and that formed a lot of like upwelling right below, right when the slab tears, you can imagine that a lot of intraplate volcanism formed. And we actually compare that model. These are the tear propagation over time with the eruption of the Columbia River flood basalt. They match pretty well, spatially and temporally. So we think this is a potentially new mechanism for lips to form. And of course, this one, you know, this doesn't tell much about the later on evolution like Yellowstone, right? That's actually one example I will talk about later on. So overall, let's to wrap up this. So forward model with data simulation, it does suffer from the uncertain initial condition. But as I said, if you know the plane motion on the surface pretty well, then that actually guarantees a not too bad solution to the present day. You know, that's one part of the convection system because you already fix it, right? So if you more or less know the viscosity structure, you can get the right solution. I mean, Peter Bonga has showed this in a lot of his papers as well. And then you can use this model to understand the geology. Of course, the relatively recent geology, because we don't know the past. That's too uncertain. The reason I actually talk quite a bit about the forward model is really the forward model is the basis for the inverse model. Okay, I mean, people are kind of fascinated about the inverse model, the air joint, or whatever. Actually, the method itself is not that much useful. I mean, you have to get the right forward model. Otherwise, the method itself doesn't help you. Okay, it's very important to realize that. And also, you know, eventually you will find this forward model actually complements the inverse model in a lot of ways. Because the forward model, as I said, it can prescribe or represent the fine scale structure, especially slabs, very much, much better than the inverse model, than tomography at least. Okay, so that's a big strength. So they go, you know, side by side. Oh, what happened? Oh, here. So, oh, just go.
Just before you move on any further, could you go back a couple of slides to your, I guess, Columbia River flood basalt slide, or maybe one of those ones. So when I last looked at some of the literature around here, a lot of people, well, some people were saying there is a plume.
Yes.
Maybe not, who knows?
Very popular, yeah.
It has burnt through the subducting slab.
Right.
And that's where you've got a hole. And that's a very different model to what you've just told us about. And this looks like it fits really nicely, and being able to fit with that local igneous geology is really neat. Mm-hmm. But your models don't have anything coming up in them.
No.
They just have things going down.
No.
So could you comment on that a
little
bit?
Yeah, very good question. I will comment on that later, actually, because these are all related. I mean, that's the thing about data simulation model. You just do things step by step, eventually it's the same model. First of all, this model, particular model, does not require a plume. Yeah, if you do have a plume, and if you assume the plume is hot and it's low viscosity, see, that's assumption, right, the general assumption. If that's the case, the plume will not penetrate the slab. It can get through the hole only when it happens to be around. So that's what we found. We had the GRL paper in 2016, and we talked about that. You have to place the plume in the very, very accurate location and time for it to penetrate through the hole. Otherwise, it doesn't do much. But this particular model, as you can imagine, it does fail to explain the existence of the flow anomaly everywhere in the Western US. So that's clearly a missing component, right? So we'll get to that. So for the pure forward model, which is mainly based on the theory of plate tectonics, we don't have flow anomaly, okay? So that's the next step. So now let's go to the inverse part. Again, that's the same equation we see in the beginning. So inverse model, you can imagine you just flip the sign of time. You know, if that works, it's pretty, right? It's beautiful. And I wish, So now let's take a little step back and look at some equations. I promise that's the only one or two slides I talk about equations. But I probably should, because there's a lot of the other students. So reversibility of mental evolution. So these are the governing equations. You know, Bruce talked about this very nicely. I assume you know the principles. You know, conservation of mass, momentum, and energy. And from this particular equation of energy, and we know that's the only equation in a way that is parameterized that has time dependence. Right? When we talk about evolution, it's all about temperature. I mean, at least at the phase level. So, and then if you look at that carefully, I rearranged it a little bit. I dropped the internal heating. I mean, for a shorter time, it doesn't matter. Then basically, you have diffusion rate versus advection rate. Okay, so these two processes are very important for the evolution of the mantle. And then we can define a non-dimensional number. I mean, forget Bruce, did you define this number? It's called the Peclet number, right? So it's a ratio between the advection and diffusion, and you get this number, right? So intuitively, this is saying the relative importance of advection over diffusion, right? If you plug in some numbers for the Earth, typical, 1,000 kilometer, velocity, 3 centimeter per year, thermal diffusivity, you get a number that's about 1,000. And remember, this is actually for the interior of the Earth, okay? And the definition of, thermal boundary layer is that within the so-called thermal boundary, there's no advection, right? So this number is zero. We're already talking about the interior of the mantle, or the mantle interior, is dominated by advection, right? So in a way, you can say a difference of 1,000 can make you safely neglect thermal diffusion in the mantle. And that's the basis of this early generation inverse models. And that's based on the kinematic reversibility of Stokes flow. Bruce mentioned this as well. It's a very well-known process for the low Reynolds number. It's like a laminar flow. The flow is actually quite reversible. So, but this is, of course, assuming you know the kinematic. Okay, so that's the conditions. And now let's watch a movie. I actually have a, I found this movie when Bruce mentioned it. It's a very famous experiment. Okay, I just want to reshare this with you. It's a big file, it's kind of slow. So it's here, okay. So this one, I think it's running. So this is experiment that shows the kinematic reversibility. It's basically like a little cylinder. Actually, it's a set of cylinders, inner one, outer one. So you can rotate one relative to the other, so you can get a shear deformation.
The annulus between them is filled with glycerine. Into this space, I introduce some dye, which stays put owing to the high viscosity of the glycerine. Note its position before I start turning it. I now turn it four times, pushing the handle clockwise. The dye seems to mix as a drop of milk mixes when it is stirred into a cup of tea. Now I reverse the direction. And after turning exactly four turns, the dyed area reappears in its original position, with a little fuzziness due to molecular diffusion. To see what happens, we have a second apparatus that is filled with...
That's fine. A lot of thermal. This is the one, it's good enough. So, that's the idea. You got the idea. Oops. You got the idea, right? So it's quite reversible. But the little fuzziness is due to like molecular diffusion, or that's general diffusion. So anyway, that's the basis for this idea of the backward or simple, what's the word I use? I mean, different people use different words here. Come on. Doesn't work. Oh, it's still syncing. So it's kind of it's a big file. And that's why I had a lot of slides. Oops, too much. Yes. So this, well, let's call it a simple backward flow. That's because, first of all, its interior element is dominated by advection, so diffusion is negligible. On the other hand, the flow velocity is purely controlled by gravity. I mean, this the driving force. And gravity is reversible. I mean, if you think about this phase value, it's just a sign issue, right? You just flip the sign of gravity, and if you know the density structure, again, that's important, then you can create or re-engineer this whole process. I mean, this is actually, oh, I can use this. So imagine this is what happened in reality in a forward case. You have gravity pointing downward. You have initial, say, like a slab. It's kind of elongated. And then fall into the lower mantle, and then, you know, it's later on form a slightly distorted geometry. And then through tomography, let's assume we see this structure. It's kind of a little fuzzy, because tomography always looks like that. And then you do the inverse, right? I mean, reverse the sign of gravity. Now gravity goes upward. And then you get some kind of solution, right? This is assuming, I know the density perfectly from that. But you can still get the wrong solution, because you don't know the viscosity, right? Question, go ahead.
When you show the equations, you're assuming that the material is compressible.
Right? It's incompressible.
That's what I mean. Yeah. This wouldn't work if the material is compressible, right? Because then...
All materials are compressible. That's like the adiabatic, right. Like the compaction effect.
But could you go back? So you're trying to go back in time with the Stokes equations, but if your material is compressible, then this wouldn't work anymore, right?
Yeah, that's the question Bruce should answer. But to the first one, I can give a quick answer. It doesn't matter. So the so-called compressibility of the mantle is because of the adiabatic effect. It's instantaneous adjustment, well, geologically speaking. So it's very fast. When you have a slab that's sinking with depth, it got compressed. As long as it gets to that depth, it's compressed very quickly to that density structure, except the temperature effect.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, mathematically, then you're going to have a time equation, a time-dependent term in your conservation of mass, right?
For the compression process?
Very often, I think you assume that the time dependence is very small.
Exactly, instantaneous.
P waves propagating through this. So usually, conservation of mass, instead of being the divergence of the velocity, is the divergence of the momentum. In that case, there is no time dependence.
Right. Just the same way we neglect the inertia, right? That's probably a more important term relative to the compressibility.
Just one last question then. What if your material is non-Newtonian?
Non-Newtonian. Oh, this is, well, so far I haven't talked about Newtonian or non-Newtonian. It's just a conceptual model.
Just thinking about the equations.
Oh, the equation. Oh, I think that's probably Newtonian. You're right. Yeah. So non-Newtonian will increase the nonlinearity for sure. Yes. And theoretically, I will talk about that later. That's a common problem, first of all. Yeah. But for the so-called adjoint model, if it's more nonlinear, you need more iterations. So there's a potential way to solve that. But again, for data estimation models, it's almost impossible to use non-Newtonian because it's so nonlinear. Yeah, I admit that. So this is one scenario. You can get another scenario. I mean, the difference between these two solutions, as I said, even though you perfectly know the density to start with, you don't know the viscosity, so the solution can be different from the true one. And that brings up these two uncertainties we have to bear in mind. That's uncertainty in density and viscosity. Yeah, density is not always directly known. I mean, Guy just talked about the, you know, the density in the mantle. You know, it's apparently still being debated. Okay, so these are a couple.
I have a question, sorry.
Yeah.
So if you go back to the previous slide, and again, I'm not a geodynamicist, so this could be really silly, but doesn't the viscosity, like, so let's say that is a blue blob, and so it's cold, and won't the viscosity depend on the fact that, like, on the structure itself?
Yes, definitely. So you're talking about lateral viscosity variation.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I would imagine that blob to have different viscosity than the surrounding material.
Yeah, I would attribute that to this term. It's uncertain. We don't know. Yeah, people are debating about the strength of the slab. Most people will say slab is stronger than amine metal. Some people will say it's even weaker. I don't know, right? So you need data, measurement. So this is like one of the earlier examples by Clint and Mike. My goodness here. So they show the reconstruction of the two superplumes. At that time, they still called it superplumes, right? It's the first time they came out. So they actually can, okay, a few more words about it. So they have plane motion imposed on the surface. So it's a semi-kinematic problem. They convert tomography to density anomaly or temperature anomaly, and they also add thermal boundary layer on top and the bottom. You know, the model looks pretty realistic. I mean, you know, from tomography, it's just a lateral perturbation. You know, that actually does not directly provide thermal boundary layer. So they do need to consider that. In a way, it's good, right? So, and then this model, it's present day, and then that goes backward to 75 MA. Well, the time here doesn't really mean that much because it really depends on the viscosity structure. But anyway, you can go backward, and then the two piles basically collapse, or the two superplumes at that time. It collapses to closer to the Coleman boundary. And then for a sanity check, you need to go from this forward in time to the present day and to check the consistency between this and that. And that's how you see the validity of the model, right? So actually, you do see the large-scale structure are pretty similar, but you do see this important instability of developing so from the Coleman boundary as well as the edges, right? So this is saying that the large-scale structure could be effectively recovered if you're only talking about long wavelengths, say dynamic topography, whatever that is, somebody covered that, I assume, or play motion, right? But a lot of the details, especially those associated with the thermal boundary layers, are not correct. And that's the key for the next step for the air-drawn model, because that's counteracting thermal diffusion. Another example, you know, by Sternberger, this actually is Smith, yeah. So Barnhart was a co-author. So again, it's a similar idea, right? So in this case, forget about the thermal boundary layer, it's always a creating problem. Let's just use the tomography, right? So you see there's no thermal boundary layer. Apparently it's not Earth-like, but it's simple. So in this case, you calculate the flow. This is cross-section from the central US. So you can see that, again, you know, the large-scale flow pattern can be reversed, and there's still problems, you know, because, I mean, if you're saying you remove the boundary layer, it will not cause problem, but actually does cause problem because clearly we know there is subduction. This is like the one, the focus subduction, and you don't have anything. You have upwelling below the subduction zone. Of course, that's to blame the tomographers because you don't resolve the slab in the first place, right? So, but anyway, this kind of model would have a limitation. If you talk about, say, particularly the evolution of Yellowstone, right? That's very much close to the subduction zone. Right? This model doesn't capture that. And this is another example we recently published, and we are looking at a similar cross-section. So this is the forward model, the subduction. I just showed this model, right? So we have the segmented slab at the present day. And if you do a simple backward flow model, so you start from the tomography, that's what tomography looked like, pretty rough, and you go backward, and you see that over time, this becomes very different. The slab structure becomes very different. I mean, which one you want to trust? And I would prefer this is more intuitive, at least. I mean, geodynamics require a lot of intuition. I mean, you may argue with me, your intuition is different from mine, that's fine. But if we know there's continuous subduction, you ought to have a continuous slab, at least. But for this case, you know, the slab goes actually backwards. So you see subduction from the continent. And you have a big gap, right? So this is like a lower portion, A, it doesn't really move at all. So that's the problem, because This has a layered viscosity. The upper mantle moves a lot faster, then the slab got stretched, so it pushes itself apart backward in time. So we know there's a problem with this, right? So for realistic viscosity, this inverse model can be invalidated. To wrap up this, the simple backward flow, if you only look at the large scale property, dynamic topography, gravity, it's good, right? It's quite effective. But the fine scale dynamics recovery is not, it's by definition not good because they neglect a lot of these details. So, and also error will grow quickly backward in time, especially for the complex rheology.
Yeah, can I ask a question on that? Like, there have been a lot of studies on the nonlinearity of mantle convection, which show that like if you have a process and it goes from like a stagnant lid into a mobile lid, if you take it back, it follows a very different path. So over what time scale is this actually applicable?
That's a very good question. That's something I try to avoid talking about. Because since I'm talking about here a pretty short time scale, I mean it's 100 million years or less, but that's nothing compared to the Earth's evolution. I mean, we can never get back to the stagnant lid convection. It was like billions of years ago. And we don't have data. So this approach would not be useful for looking at that problem.
I think there was some work from Nicola Coltis. And I think he calculated like 200 or 300 million years.
200 is OK. Yeah.
No?
Well, it's more uncertain going backward in time anyway. So 200 is like probably the limit, if you believe, yeah.
I mean, if you look at the early Steinberger papers, for example, right, there are estimates in there, and it depends on the diffusion. And so like 40 million years or something like that is a more realistic number.
Yeah.
I mean, you can basically think of, you know, you don't have any control over the boundary layers. If a plume forms at the core middle boundary, however long it takes it to make it to the surface is going to mess things up. So that's the kind of stuff you're never going to be able to predict.
Right, exactly. So so with that, let's make one step further. We can talk about the so-called adjoint method. So so still this is the same equation, and I want to flip the sign. So now I ask, can you really now do this, right? Actually, we did this for the simple backward equation. We did this, but with a lot of restrictions. So for the adjoint, can we simply flip the sign of time, and effectively, yes, we are. You know, we are doing this backward in time. You know, you get a initial condition. Eventually, that's actually better constrained because you use a lot information from the present day, which the forward model can never capture, right? So, but that's just effective. You know, as I said. Oops, what happened here? Okay, so when I say effective, I mean it's not directly backward in time because the adjoint method is actually designed to overcome a diffusive evolutionary process. Okay, so focus on diffusion. So if you think about the governing equations of mantle convection, right, advection and diffusion, usually this is well posed in the forward time. That's the positive time step. If you say you want to try the negative time, it's like a cartoon, and good for lecture. So this is a thermal diffusion problem. So present day, I have a very smooth thermal profile. It's a Gaussian, and the edge is like kind of like a smooth as well. So I want to try these two scenarios. One is with integration forward in time, and the other is integration backward in time, just directly using a negative time step. Okay, and then what you see here, you know, very quickly, you see the difference. Let's just run all the way to the back, right? So this is the well post, this is the yield post, because Laplacian is not reversible, okay? That's the Laplacian term. So then you can see that mathematically and physically, this is not allowed, right? It violates the second order thermodynamics. So then what should they do, right? An actual adjoint algorithm is like this. So there's nothing magic. It's kind of like doing tomography, like even the traditional travel time tomography. It's an iterative process. Let's assume the true states of the mantle is like sometime in the past, the initial condition, and that's the final. And then you actually start with some kind of estimate of the initial condition. You run the model forward. And then often you get a mismatch. And you define a cost function. And then what you do next is the so-called adjoint. That is, you basically derive a gradient of the cost function relative to the temperature, to the forward temperature. And then you fit that as a source to the so-called adjoint equation. And I will quickly derive that afterwards. And then that generates a residual back at the initial time, and then you can use this term to correct your first initial condition. So iteratively, you do this until you reach convergence criteria. So what you need here, so you need a gradient. It's very important. It's a gradient method, right? And you need the adjoint equation, and you need this relationship, right? And the governing equation, or the governing, the key equation here is, so to get a gradient, here, you know, I define my cost function, capital J, as a temperature misfit between the prediction and observation over time and space. But in effect, because we are not doing like a meteorological or oceanography models, we have a measurement throughout the time. We only have the present day, right? So we actually do this with the delta functions, only present day. So then what you do here, you define the Lagrangian function, and you what you do here is you take a perturbation. Oh, you construct the Lagrangian function such that you have the cost function plus the governing equation itself integrated over time and space, and then you do, and then you want to minimize that, right? Then you take a derivative of that, then the derivative of everything in here, and then you, what you do next, you do an integration by part. So you separate out the predicted parameter and the residual. Oops, where is this? And then you got an equation. So my lambda is my adjoint or Lagrangian multiplier, or I call it adjoint quantity. In this case, it's adjoint temperature. It's a residual temperature. It has the same unit as the forward temperature. So it's symmetric. And then you got this equation out. I mean, if you compare this equation versus that equation, and you see that the vector term has the opposite sign. Where is this? The diffusion term had the opposite sign. So, okay, so kappa, so this is the plus, and that's minus. Okay, so this is saying this equation is well posed backward in time, effectively, okay? And then you need another relationship, right? So you can mathematically show that the gradient of the cost function relative to the temperature at the initial time, and that's actually derived if we assume this cost function is defined over the entire time frame, and you can show that that's equal to the residual or the adjoint quantity at the initial time. We're not going.
Yeah,
to
could that. I maybe just make a comment?
Sure.
The point, I guess, is that the Laplacian term is well defined because you're integrating backwards in time, like time is going in the opposite direction, right?
Right, right, yes. And also, it's important to have the cost function defined in the L2 norm. It's very important. So
I guess my only point is that equation wouldn't be well posed if you integrated forward in time. This equation, right? It has to go backwards.
Exactly, it has to go backwards. There's only one choice. So, and now let's look at a 1D, very simple 1D kinematic problem, right? So my initial condition is a hot mantle like a plume in the lower mantle, and then I advect that upward to the upper mantle in the final time. I assume I know the velocity, and then this profile got, you know, smear down a little bit, so it's a broader and shorter, and that's my reference state. Now my target is I try to recover that initial condition from that, and assume the tomography gives me a perfect imaging of that, right? Also the density. Well, it's debated the density, but let's assume that's doable. And then to start off, you give it an arbitrary, you know, cold and hot, like a very complex initial condition, totally wrong from the true solution. And then you do the integration. Remember here, I assume I know the velocity, okay, kinematic problem. And you get a prediction, and then you get a big mismatch. That's the mismatch at the present day. Then you do the backward integration. As Bruce said, this adjoint equation can only go backward in time, okay, so you have no choice. And then, but the theory is actually still going forward. It's not forward, it's still going in a well-posed sense. That's why this profile becomes fatter and shorter in the initial time, okay? And then you have a correction term. You can correct this initial condition. So you do this iteratively after 5 iterations, and that's the initial condition. And the residual here, these are the residuals. They are a lot smaller now. And if you do 15 iterations, you know, things look almost like perfect. And if you look at the residual field, it's kind of like a, you know, kind of like a multi-level, multi-grade process. So you first correct the long wavelength pattern, and you're left behind with small wiggles, you know. Eventually, you're left with not a white noise, but kind of like a very random noise left. So you cannot, still you cannot, you can say that you can recover the long wavelengths better than the short wavelengths. It depends on the time scale, of course. So that's the, you know, misfit for the initial and final is actually converting. So here, You can see that for this particular problem, it's unconditionally converging, which is very, promising. Looks very promising. But the reason is really because this is a kinematic problem. In other words, it's a linear problem, right? It's a linear problem, and the gradient down the downhill gradient is actually well defined. But in reality, we know many convection is nonlinear because you have this advection term, the velocity term. Here, I assume it's known. So with that, you have to have a very good first guess. Okay, otherwise you will go off different directions. Eventually you will probably fall into a local minimum instead of a global minimum. So, and that's why we know, this is like a simple test I did for free convection problem. You see like the slab, or plume rising up. These are recovery of the initial condition using different initial guess. This is like an empty mantle. And eventually they show differences. And the best solution, this one, is actually a solution that's based on initial guess, and that's obtained using a simple backward integration. So what I'm saying here, the so-called simple backward direction is very useful for a joint because it provides the preconditioner, provides a priori constraint. It's actually all connected together. This is another example by Ismail Zadeh like a few years ago. So one of the earlier papers talking about the adjoint. So this is actually recovering a cluster of plumes. So this is the backward wait. Oh, that's the initial condition. That's the present day image plume cluster, and that can be recovered backward to the initial condition. That's pretty much like the true initial. I'm not showing that, but it's just smoother than this. And then if you run the model forward in time, you get similar structures. So in a way, this approach actually also uses a similar idea, that is, your first guess is a simple backward integration, backward flow. So that's important. However, this might be a little confusing because Peter Bonga, which is also a real pioneer of the adjoint method, he actually made a slightly different conclusion in his first paper saying that, just look at this real quick. So reference states here, so he's actually using a data simulation model. So you impose plane motion over time and you get reference initial condition and final condition. And remember, this initial is kind of like halfway. It's already structured in there. And he tried to recover this from that by starting with the empty mantle. And he claims eventually you get everything back almost perfectly. So in a way, it doesn't depend on the first guess. It's a little bit confusing if you compare these two models. But if you really think about this, this is a kinematic problem, because you assume you know the plane motion. But the plane motion is always assumed to be known. As I said earlier, that's also the power of the forward model. If you know the perfect surface kinematics, your solution is not too off, right? You can perturb it, and then you will easily recover to the true solution. So it's not the case for free convection, like plume is a free convection. It's actually a lot harder. Okay, I'm doing okay. I'm okay. So. Now I want to talk about the limitations of the adjoint method itself even. So as I said, adjoint model is heavily dependent on tomography. If you say, because that's the input. So this is the Western US model I showed you earlier. So at different depths, this is the forward model prediction, and that's basically tomography. At present day, simple backward is a tomography, and that's the adjoint. So the prediction to that, you see it's quite close. Although the slab is actually not well predicted, because that's a thermal boundary process, which is not well recovered, even for the adjoint. And this is, I want to introduce, this is a hybrid. Basically, this is a combination of adjoint and the forward. Then the forward takes care about the linear feature of the slab, and the adjoint takes care of the other features in the tomography. So it's a pretty delicate algorithm. We actually tossed and handled this paper. Thanks for allowing this to publish. So this is like a 0 million years. If you go back to 20 million years, the forward model, of course, because it's defined and it's all reasonable. The slab is cold. The plate is cold. The slab is cold. It's linear. But for the simple backward, you see that you got the chunks of material put back to the surface. And that's because the tomography starts that way, right? So there's no way you can recover a homogeneous slab or plate from a broken tomography in the first place. But a joint model does a little bit better job, but still, there's a lot of heterogeneity, especially there's a lot of hard mantle that's still underneath the Western US. And we know that at that time there's no volcanism, not much, but you've got a lot of hard mantle. See, that's because the mantle flow direction is not entirely right. And that's because this model misses the slab. And that's why in the hybrid model, we add in the slab to this model, we actually percolate most of the hard mantle to the ocean side. Okay, and this is like looking at the cross section, the same approach. You see that the inverse model, I showed this already, the slab goes actually the opposite way even. So the adjoint model is slightly better, but see the hard mantle is all disturbed everywhere. But for the hybrid model, because you have a better defined slab, you know, the mantle flow direction is more correct, like more realistic, let's put it that way. Eventually the details are slightly different. I will get to this particular hybrid model later if I have time. Okay, so with this, these are the mathematical description of the data simulation approaches. See here I say however. However, all these data simulation or inverse models in particular, it has a problem. Okay, so it works only for idealized mental scenarios. In other words, it works only when you assume you know perfectly the density structure, you know perfectly the viscosity structure, which is neither of these is correct, right? So, and these uncertainties could actually dramatically change your initial condition, therefore your prediction can be totally off. And for example, if you look at one, again, quick example, a sinking blob, it's pretty ugly slab. So that's the reference state, okay? Now I start by asking, well, if I want to recover the initial condition from this tomography image, okay, I give 100% credit to tomography, it's doing a perfect job, and you want to recover that. But you have to know the density, you have to know the viscosity, right? The tomography actually provides the geometry. So let's assume this is my true temperature or density converted from tomography. This is my true, sorry, not converted, but the reference value. And this is my true viscosity. And from tomography, you know, if you try very hard, you can get maybe, let's see, not very hard, maybe you don't do a very good job, you say you're a factor two off from the true density, and you're a factor two off from the viscosity, which is not too bad, actually, given the large uncertainty. Then you run the inverse model, that's your initial condition. See, that's the same thing, right? Because this blob is not as heavy, and this viscosity is a lot higher, it's like twice as high, it doesn't move much, right? The initial condition only place the slab in the lower mantle still, and that's different from this. But just from the adjoint method itself, we don't know this is wrong. It perfectly converges, right? So how do we know this is wrong? And so that goes to the uncertainty model parameter. I think it's actually more important than the adjoint method itself. That is, we need to find surface response that can play constraints on this uncertainty parameter. And the one possible observation we use is so-called dynamic topography. So when this blob is sinking, it generates viscous stress at the base of the lithosphere, and that caused deflection of the topography, we call it dynamic topography. And the reference of this dynamic topography is the red line, so recorded from this borehole. But if you look at this first model, right, the predicted dynamic topography is entirely flat. And that's because it's always deep, right? It doesn't affect the slab surface as much. Oh, really?
So you mentioned that the adjoint method depends a lot on the choice of our knowledge about the viscosity and density structure of the matter. But the forward model also depends on these choices, right? We
yes.
we don't really know how the viscosity
yes.
depends on the temperature in the
yes.
matter. So would the forward model with the wrong material properties give the same result? So I'm just asking. You said the
right.
adjoint method suffers from this limitation.
Right, no.
But our forward
no.
models suffer from the same limitations.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Actually, there are actually two parts in your question. First is the adjoint and the forward. Actually, the adjoint, the uncertainty in the adjoint entirely depends on the forward model. The adjoint model actually is a forward model iteratively solving the equations. So it's the same process. The errors are actually all carried by the forward model. There's a forward component in the adjoint, right? So the same process. And back to whether the forward model will predict the wrong solution if your viscosity structure, say, is not correct. Yeah, absolutely, you will miss it, you know. And then that's why this forward model actually provides a good constraint for viscosity. We were chatting with Carolina the other day. If you track the slab geometry over time and compare with tomography, that provides a very effective constraint for mental viscosity. Yeah, effective viscosity, okay. So, and then, okay, go back to this. I will not show the analytical dependence, but it's a very elegant derivation you can get. Well, in this paper actually, we talked about that a little bit. So the dynamic topography provides a direct constraint for the density anomaly and the viscosity. So you use these differences over time, and both their amplitude and their rate of change, you can actually effectively recover this mantle viscosity and density and viscosity. And eventually, so the solution converges to the dynamic topography, and your initial condition recovered is pretty much close to that. Right? Forget about the little tail. It's kind of like a, you know, it's an artificial model anyway. So with that, I want to still have time here. Okay.
But this means you need to have a good model for dynamic topography in the past, right?
Yes.
In the geological past,
yes.
Like something with sedimentation or?
Exactly, from the observation side, exactly, yeah. So that actually raised the question, you cannot do this everywhere. You want to find like tectonically stable region like cratons, right? If there's signals, you can use it. For the tectonically active region, forget about it. So that's like one of the examples, like going back to the, my PhD work. So we are trying to recover the so-called Farallon slab, which is pretty well imaged. That's in the East Coast, backward in time. You know, I will not go to the details again, but.
Legion, I just wanted to add something.
Yeah.
You know, one big difference with what they do in meteorology or oceanography and so on, and you mentioned it already, is that they use data, right?
Right.
We're not using data. We're using models of data as our data constraint, right?
I mean, even tomorrow,
and therefore,
tomorrow, yeah.
Well, yeah,
yes,
as swarf plate
right.
reconstructions,
right?
And,
right.
And therefore, there should be errors associated
yeah.
with that, and that
yeah.
introduces, you know, some serious
right.
issues in the adjuncts, which really haven't been.
I know, and that's
considered.
Where there's error everywhere. I totally agree. You know, that's why we are.
But it might make you reach the conclusion that there is certain behavior of a slab that is due to X or Y, which might not be true. It's just because things are canceling out in a.
Right. I totally agree. Yes, yes. So you, in this case, because it's a mathematical model, you are forced to get a solution. And if there's errors in your model input, which is very likely, you end up having like trade-offs in your model parameters or your conclusion. So it's a model, yeah. So I mean, for this particular model, you know, we recover the Farallon slab and it forms the flat slab, and it actually depressed the surface dynamically, and we found that actually matches the interior seaway with the Western U.S. It's a transient inundation of Western U.S. People talk a lot about the flat slab, actually, we also recover the flat slab here. And you can see that a piece of flat slab. Looks like my time is limited. I will probably jump a little bit more faster here. So let's see. And then we forget about that. This particular flat slab is very well known from geology, right? And we try to provide more constraint on that. And again, data simulation models are very expansible. So if you look at the recovery of we're trying to identify that flat slab, and it looks like it's a conjugate of one of the oceanic plateaus, Ledeshatsky, right? It's a subduction process that seems to correlate with the Laramide orogeny in the Western U.S. It's a very peculiar mountain building because it's far away from the plate boundary. Okay, so one straightforward prediction is dynamic topography. You know, there's likely trade-off, you don't want to cross all the details. But overall, you see a migration pattern where, you know, Cretaceous part, earlier time, the Western U.S. is low because it's dynamically depressed. And then when the Atlantic Ocean opens up, the North America moved westward and the depression moved to the East Coast. So this actually is more or less consistent with the recent high topography in the West. Qualitatively, I have to say that. Oops. Oh yeah, we then look at the more detailed, like a migration of a lot of these, you know, proxies for substance uplift, erosion, and even tilting, and it seems to match. And you know, again, a model. You can also look at the river evolution. These are the rivers reconstructed by the geomorphologist, and they seem to match the reconstruction at different time. This is like the sinusoidal part. So, for the sake of time, I will skip this. So I want to talk about the model of this hybrid model we recently ran, because this allows us to look at finer scale processes. For example, the Yellowstone or the Yellowstone volcanic province is very complex. You initially have a large in this province going north-south, and then you have east-west, and oppositely moving hotspot tracts. It's very complex. So, and then the model here we use is the most recent tomography model by Brandon Schmidt, Lin, Fanqi, and then this is the tomography, and that's the prediction. I mean, by definition, it has to match because that's our starting point anyway. But the difference here, we do have a difference that is the forward part of the model. better predict the slab geometry. So the same cross section, you see the difference now is we have velocity vectors. So we convert that to a model, then you really ask the question, this is the plume, people you recall, that's Yellowstone, and there's actually a lot of even bigger volume of slow anomaly in the thin field depths everywhere below Western US. So the other question is, these two systems, are they the same? Or are they behaving differently? If you look at this model, what it shows here is that these two hot mantle systems evolve separately. So the shallow part of the hot mantle basically retreats toward the Pacific Ocean. And eventually the conclusion here, we found the heat that's filling, that's powering Yellowstone actually predominantly comes from the Pacific asthenosphere or upper mantle. And the plume here is actually controlled very much by the slab surrounding it, kind of sinking overall. And that's like another view of this. So you see the hot mantle intruding. That's the Columbia River flood basalt initially, and then the intruding progressively toward Yellowstone. So this plume is sitting there, is at least is not doing much. We can vary the viscosity and density of the plume, but still it's not dominant, it's kind of small. And then that's a very complex mantle flow we conclude from this kind of model. It's super complex. You have the active fire along, one of Fuca, you have the old fire along, you have the intruding hot mantle. The plume is somewhere here. It's a model, right? As I said, this model can well be wrong. I mean, we are lucky we come up with a story. But then, I mean, any model needs validation, right? So if you look at one of the validation is the anisotropy. It's a very complex, but it's a well-measured feature of Western US. So for that particular model, we actually tested the flow and then anisotropy effect from all these different parameters. And this is like a combination of all. And we actually get a pretty good match of the anisotropy. So if you look at the different parts of that, the big circular pattern there, and the especially the Oregon part, the Yellowstone part, is very, very strongly deformed. So if you look at the particular contribution, so the hot mantle is actually required to form this branch of an anisotropy circle. And then we have this broad toroidal flow, actually exactly pretty much controlled by the Farallon slab because it's flowing eastward. And this lithosphere thickness variation divert the flow northward from the circle.
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by good match?
Good question. Yeah, I need to show alternative models, which is in the backup slides. So I can show they're a lot worse. And we did also calculate the regional average misfit, and this again is the smallest misfit. So I
was actually also going to ask, if you just go back one slide, please.
Sure.
There seems to be lots of disagreement within sort of Washington.
Absolutely. So the misfit are, right, I agree. I know. Seismology look like have a different standard than general numbers. So on the edges, it's pretty off, but that's edge effect. You know, our model tomography only covered North America, right? Only US, not Canada. And in the Creighton part, it's also off. You can say that's probably false one anisotropy. As for the good fit, it really is in the tectonically active basin range. So I actually look at the same model. We also look at the stress in the lithosphere. It matches perfectly well. But again, only in the active part. So
it's an edge effect rather than a particular flow pattern within the model that could be telling us something interesting dynamically.
Sorry, didn't get you.
So the fact that they're so, they disagree with each other so strongly beneath Washington and Oregon,
mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether that was the predictions that you make were generated by a particular flow pattern in the model that you think is significant,
yes.
Which we can now rule out. I mean, does it tell us something about how things flow around a potential slab?
Right, I think this part, I think this part is due to the edge effect because the thick craton or the thick lithosphere is only for this region. Canada is empty mantle, almost everywhere is lithosphere. So it's a very strong return flow coming in. Yeah. So that will probably at least solve the problem. But we all realize, you all read this paper, right? Like the, Nelson and Grant, they have this, they really image this lower mantle plume. I guess the new question really is, I don't think my model is entirely wrong. And I believe that I always give like the highest credit to the tomographer. I think they're also right. Then the question is, what is the, how to reconcile this, right? So really the heat source, like for this paper, they argue this is the plume. And this is something else. But actually, according to our model, this is the key that caused the hotspot drag. So the question really is, What are the relationship between this and this? Could be this like a fossil plume head, or it's like just a hot, as soon as they're like a fingers, like people talk about hot fingers, like Barbara Romanovich, so they talk about this, as soon as they may have residual heat. I mean, that, I don't know which is correct, but that's like an interesting question to ask, right? So with that, let me just conclude. I am on time, good. So I would say geodynamic models with data simulation is actually promising for more quantitative, let's put it that way, understanding the deep Earth dynamics. And there's actually a lot more work to do, because we know there's all, actually the more data you incorporate, the more potential source of error you incorporate. So ultimately to overcome that problem, we need to find more constraints or more ways to constrain the model. This is like something I think we can think about, like, can have better simulation schemes, or you can have even coupling, so you can incorporate more observation like mineral physics, seismology, even surface processes, you know, geochemistry into the model, which is something we probably can talk about next week. So, yeah, so with that, I want to summarize or echo the theme of the CIDR, this same figure we saw, right? I think like data simulation in a way is good because it's actually a system approach. It's good for complex system understanding. And if you do this properly, I hope eventually, like a dream, I would say, instead of like different people touching the elephant, we say this is the same people that touch the different parts of the elephant. And that can probably change the understanding or increase the understanding of the system. Okay, thank you.
When you talk about anisotropy, how long do you have to run a model for to remove the effect of like the inherited, whatever the anisotropy was before the model?
Yeah, it depends. You know, that depends on the strain rate or the total amount of strain. You know, from Merriman people, I mean, Thorsten has a much better understanding for this. But usually for the code, we assume as long as the area reached like a one, like value of cumulative strain of one, then it's resetting the previous. And for this particular model, you can see that we found its 10 million year evolution is actually enough to form the circular pattern, because the flow is so rapid in Western US.
I can comment on that. I mean, it's a very good question, and the quick one is we have no idea. And it's so the way we approached this in 2006 was to use a mineral physics tool like D-Rex and do synthetic experiments, sticking in fabrics and reworking it. And the answer there is a finite strain of about 10. And so when you look in terms of how long does that take, typically it's sort of 10 to 20 million years, depending where you are in the asthenosphere. And so that gives you an idea in the advection paths. You could do histograms of that. But the problem with these computations is that at the time there were zero, and now there are very few laboratory experiments that actually explore this very question. You know, here's a texture, and what happens if I rework it? And it turns out that when you do these experiments, then the mineral physics tools we've been using do a very poor job at actually capturing that. And so, you know, we have theoretical answers there, but I think we're still awaiting a more complete theoretical description of the LPO formation to answer that more confidently.
Right. Actually, I since I'm here, I want to answer like Michael's question one more time. So you know, there are, for this kind of models, you know, we cannot say like, you know, absolutely which model is the best, but we can test different hypotheses. So like this is like when you only look at the lithosphere effect, like lithosphere thickness variation, people say that, you know, the edge-driven flow is the reason, and then you can get LPO, and you can get the SKS, and this one is quite off. I didn't use the most up-to-date figure, but this one has a general misfit like more than 45 degrees. Then if you look at, if you further include the one focal plate, the circle is out, but it's off, right? And then here, if you include the so-called Farallon slab, is a more eastward flow. You see the flow change direction. That's actually dramatic. So here, seeing the transition zone, the flow is kind of like westward. But if you include that, it's actually going eastward. So that expands the circle toward the Criton. And that's like the final one. If you include that, the fit is kind of this actually slightly different model. You know, it's still not perfect, but it's actually better. So, Thorsten.
Yeah,
Louis, sorry.
I just want to, so in the interest of coming back to the sort of teaching side of everything,
right?
We learned a little bit of, we always learn a little bit about the seismology resolution, because they do checkerboard tests, and we know that the checkerboard test is not perfect, but it's a very interesting way to look at, I mean, it's an honest way to present something, right? To say, we really can see nothing here. And it's not obvious to me, with these much more complicated things, mm-hmm. how you're going to present that uncertainty, and for people who don't have experience, I mean, you've presented how complex this is, right? And it's still very hard to even tease out what's going on.
How
are people going to get an understanding of what you can and can't see? What is your null space here? What can you never, ever see in these models? How are you going to present that, and how are the students going to learn?
Yeah, it's a very fair question. I got that question like 100 times. So the again, I mean, it's probably there's absolutely no way to present the actual uncertainty. But again, it's probably this kind of approach still at this level. I think it's good for testing hypothesis instead of for say uncertainty in plain motion. You can try different reconstructions, right, and see which one matches better. And you can try different tomography. That's actually what we did. You can even try different anisotropy measurements, right? They all give different answers, slightly different answers. So again, finally, there's a group of model, probability-wise, that give you a solution. It's not one model. Yeah, I know, it's difficult, yeah.
I guess my question will follow up a bit on Louis' point, which is, you know, when I see this, I don't think so much about the uncertainties in the geodynamical modeling because I do not understand them. But I do understand something about the uncertainties in the tomography.
Okay.
And to me, it's very difficult because some of the most dynamically or potentially dynamically active features, like plumes, for example, also happen to pose profound challenges as an imaging problem, right?
Yeah.
Additionally, our ability to retrieve things like precise shapes and amplitudes of heterogeneity are limited, whereas we are fairly good at kind of getting the general patterns, but not necessarily the amplitudes. But from kind of a simple view, I would think that the amplitude actually has a substantial effect on mental flow. So I wonder, or maybe, And this is not a criticism of you, this is a criticism of all of us, the way that we kind of approach these problems is we are like, oh, I'll take this model because I know that person, or I'm friends with them, or they went to the same school that I did, or whatever.
It's common.
And so we run these models, and we don't know whether the features in our models is just happens to be some result of a peculiarity in like the relative data weighting, or some other assumptions that went into creation of the models. So I guess I would propose to the geodynamicists that maybe looking at what is common across tomographic models rather than looking at a single tomographic model is the right approach.
So Thorsten has an answer to that. Are you answering
17 me? Different answers, but just to that particular point, right? So, of course, it's sort of in general true that to make any geodynamic inferences, it's hard to do that based on one model. So really you want to explore the sensitivities with a range of models, right? And so there's a number of different ways of doing that. And one of the things, for example, that Megan and I did when we looked at anisotropy is we explored basically a huge matrix where one axis is the density as represented by different tomographic models or different assumptions about density structure. And the other axis is viscosity. Right? As you know, we heard, it's the density and the viscosity that drives the flow, and so it's natural to use those two axes. And when you do that for a certain problem, you do find that certain things, like whatever, the effects of keels are really important, and other things give you sort of similar misfit. And we're of course not in a position where we can fully explore the parameter space, but I think an immediate, very straightforward step is instead of doing three models, it's like, you know, let's just do 1,000, something like that. Not a million, but like 1,000 forward models, and then you can explore that. And I think, you know, people have done that, and you do find certain settings where you have very robust conclusions, right? For instance, P-wave models suck in terms of driving the planes, because you don't have surface waves and you miss the oceanic, the upper oceanic structure, something we knew before. And hopefully sometimes we do that and we learn something else that we didn't know before in terms of the input models.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's probably the most objective way of doing this. But the problem is it's so expensive. One single model of this takes weeks to run.
Yeah, maybe just to echo that point is that it's wonderful to run 1,000 models. Try doing that with nonlinear viscosity, which actually what you need in order to get isotropy.
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah,
so
big
we're
assumption.
Limited, right? Still. I need more computer time. Right. We know how to solve the problem, but we're still time limited. I mean, you still.
Yeah.
To be able to run the models that have the parameters that we think exist.
Okay, sure. So if you're going to do the adjunct, right, there's a ton of applied math literature on doing, you know, being able to do it with.
Okay, the max. Yeah.
There's a lot of applied math literature and computational fluid dynamics literature on actually being able to do 1,000 models in a way that is computationally feasible, right? You just have to pose the problem in a different way.
Okay.
And so that you can have, you know, many models and you can build in the covariance matrices so that you know which parts of your model and which parts of your predictions are sensitive to which type of data. And that's the way to go, right? Because we are actually missing fundamental physics too, and we could be trading off physics and coming up with solutions that, you know, mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah. I totally agree with everything you said. I mean, that's from a theoretical point of view, we know that's the way to go. It's just, but when you say 1,000 models, I mean, at least this kind of model is not doable. like the global model I presented, like the forward model itself, it took like 2 months on 3,000 cores. So that's one model. It's impossible. Oh, maximum, yeah.
Yeah, this is another follow-up on, I guess, the uncertainty question brought up by Louis. Well, I guess one thing we usually do is we use observations or models based on observations to test our forward models of geodynamical forward models. In your case, you're already using a lot of observations to assimilate your model, right?
Yeah.
So in the end, you showed that, for example, then you use dynamic topography to test your model. And then I agree with Thorsten that you should go through different viscosity structures and so on and so forth. So the question is, how do you decide which data are you using to assimilate the model and which data are you using to test the model?
Mm-hmm.
There are other data, for example, like distribution of volcanism, maybe even geochemistry of volcanism that you could use. Is there a good approach?
So maybe I didn't make it clear. Like for the North American inverse model, yes, we use the dynamic topography as a constraint, and then we use say the proxy for erosion and exhumation for the river erosion. These are our validations, and we actually also use. I skipped one slide. We also couple that to the surface process models and the river migration. These are additional constraints. So actually, we found problem with this model. This model does have a lot of problems. But the first order pattern is okay. Yeah, so that actually allows you to further improve the model. Yes.
How quantitative are you doing these comparisons? Like, for example,
it's
with
very
looked how qualitative in a way.
That's right. So you look at the river channel, right? We're basically talking about like a drainage plane, like the drainage basin area, roughly like a river drainage divide, like this kind of thing. It's hard to quantify, right? You're right. It's qualitative. It's still qualitative. Because the different data have different nature. Yeah.
And I think this is a very good point, and it speaks to this issue that we touched on earlier that Carolina brought up, and is, you know, we like to use the evolution of plate tectonics as some sort of constraint that our dynamic models should match. But however, you know, the plate reconstructions themselves are models, and we wish we could inform them with dynamic rules to make them more plausible and hopefully arrive at a most likely scenario plus uncertainties. And it's interesting, and someone brought up Nico Coltis's work earlier, that when you look at this, you can set up a system where you say, you know where the plate boundaries are right now, and we have different answers. There's some uncertainties, as Lijun pointed out, but we feel like we understand sort of what drives the plates. However, if you then do a different experiment and you allow a convection computation to have the plate boundaries evolve, then things go completely haywire on timescales of 10 to 20 million years, right? And this is telling us that whatever we are doing, right, and there hasn't been quite a convergence between people who do circulation modeling, convection modeling, whatever we are doing, the limitation of our knowledge of plate boundary evolution is so large that we have really no idea of how to deal with deforming plates. And this is what you want, right? You don't want to just push the plates around by hand of God rigidly. You'd like to have a model that predicts the deformation, and we're not there yet. And so this whole plate boundary evolution problem is a big one. Right. So if you do everything right back to 10 MA, you know, you will not end up at the present day. And it's kind of sad, maybe not surprising in some sense, but there's a real challenge here. And I think once and if the challenge can be overcome, then we have a much wider range of data from geology that we can use to test our models mm-hmm. and get to a sort of a planetary evolution model.
Yeah, so we do have a lot of geology, and that's the key thing we try to run a landscape evolution model, because there are a lot of details, you know, it's like a more quantitative, I mean, quote-unquote, representation of the proxies we used earlier on. I mean, so that I'm going to play this one more time, so you can see the dynamic topography, surface topography, and river evolution. These are going northward, westward initially, as we look at time, and then the seaway, and then you see the formation of the seaway. And also this tilted strata is a very typical property of the strata in western interior. It's all tilted eastward, you know, which we model that as well. The river also changed direction over time, you know, in the Senegal it's going this way, and the Mississippi going that way. These are all qualitative, again, right? But there's a lot of this, how to say, hard to describe information you can think about. But I really think like mode coupling is the way to say it. Go ahead.
Watching this movie, I was wondering, you know, the western margin of North America has undergone a tremendous evolution during the duration of the movie that you just played for us.
Oh, so totally wrong, that part. Yeah, totally wrong. I mean, this kind of model, this is the dynamic part we use. It's the model without thermal boundary layer. It's the global grand tomography. This is orogeny. This kind of model cannot simulate orogeny, so forget about that.
Yeah, but these orogenies didn't even happen geographically in the same location where they're being plotted now, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. We just imposed a fixed severe orogeny that extends all the way to the present day, which is entirely wrong. But it's correct in a way that this is always a drainage divide. So it divides the river from west to east. So to the west, we don't talk about it.
One question. So my question is also related to the viscosity and the density uncertainty. So viscosity and the density are highly dependent on temperature. So now, assume we know the viscosity and the density very well as present day. Can we invert the viscosity and the density in the same way as you did inverting temperature?
I think we could, but people may disagree. Yes, as I said, like if you really know the plate reconstruction and you know the present day tomography, let's say Western US is one of the best example, you try to match the predicted slab geometry and the observed one, there's a very strong constraint. Actually, I did that just by a factor of two variations of viscosity, the slab structure is entirely off. So it's a very, very, potentially very good constraint, but that's based on Newtonian viscosity. Magli may not agree. But overall, we actually have very weak slabs. To put a little bit more in, our slabs are kind of weak. You know, that's very different from the laboratory-based reality. You get slabs very strong. So strong slab cannot deform. Then you cannot get that kind of segmented slab pattern. So something we don't know yet about the reality. Oh yeah, plasticity. Okay. Yes, that's what I think. Right, exactly. Plasticity or fault, you know, you can think about that in a way. Yes. Right. Exactly, yeah, I agree. Okay. A lot to discuss.
So what I'm gonna call it.
Thank you.